Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Sanctuary, War Against the Living Dead, by Sean Harbinger. Narrated by John Keating. Chapter 1. The helicopter dropped through the clouds, and I saw an island below. The pilots took us lower, until the Chinook was flying just a few feet above the choppy waves. As we got closer to the island, I saw a rocky shoreline, cliffs and trees. "This island has no name," Ian Hart said, his voice coming through the headset in my flight helmet. "It does, however, have buildings and a landing pad. We can rest here for a while. God knows we need it." His voice was full of anger and regret. The people he'd known and worked with at Site Bravo 1, Apocalypse Island, were all dead, ripped apart by each other, thanks to the Brigadier's virus-filled bomb. We gained altitude and flew over the island, allowing me to get a good look at the place through the window. It was vaguely horseshoe-shaped, with a cove, tree-covered hills, and a wide clearing. Buildings huddled together in the clearing. I could see a hangar and a landing pad, with a large H painted on it. The Chinook descended and landed on the pad. The pilot cut the engine, and the rotors slowed before stopping completely. Everyone piled out of the chopper and onto the tarmac. A cool, salt-tanged breeze came in from the coast, rustling through the trees around us. "Be alert," Hart said. "As far as I know, there was no one on this island when the virus broke out, but we can't be too careful." He nodded to the three members of the security team. They raised their carbines and approached the seemingly deserted buildings as a tight unit. "We'll wait here until they clear the area," he said. I did a quick head count. Lucy, Sam, Tanya, myself, Hart, his three team members, and the helicopter pilot and co-pilot. 10 of us. We were all armed, but we wouldn't have much chance if this island was crawling with zombies. "What is this place?" Lucy asked, looking at the main three-story building and the surrounding smaller ones.
"Science outpost," Hart said. "Abandoned a while ago. The scientists who worked here didn't like the isolation. And I understand the weather got quite bad on occasion."
"What were they studying?"
"Marine biology."
"So this wasn't a military base?" I asked. He shook his head.
"Civilian. This was a government-funded project to study marine animals and their habitats."
"Why here?" Lucy asked. "On this island, I mean."
"There's a reef near here that had some value to the scientific community. This place was built as a base of operation. The reef is only a short boat ride away, so it made sense to build the labs here."
I wondered how Hart knew so much about the place, if the science project was civilian and not military. I decided not to ask, though. I had more immediate concerns, like staying alive if the buildings around us were inhabited by the living dead. I was glad that the pilot and his female co-pilot had elected to wait near the cockpit. If things went sideways, they'd be able to start the engines quickly and get us the hell out of here. The trio of security guards returned and nodded to Hart.
"The buildings are clear," he said. "Let's get inside."
We moved away from the landing pad and crossed the grass to the main building. A large, three-story structure with windows that were treated with some kind of dark coating that made them opaque from the outside. We made our way inside through a steel door and found ourselves standing in a wide foyer with functional white tiles on the floor, a staircase that led up to the next level, and a number of corridors leading to other sections of the building.
"The canteen is this way," Hart said, leading us along one of the corridors. "Should be a place to sit for all of us. We can plan our next move from there."
The canteen was a large room with black and white checkered floor tiles, a long metal serving area, and steel doors that led to the kitchen, I suddenly realized how hungry I was. When was the last time I'd eaten?
Too long ago.
The room was furnished with wooden tables and chairs. The windows, which were transparent from inside the building, looked down over the cove. There was a sandy beach down there, as well as a long wooden dock that jutted out into the sea. "Why did they leave the furniture?" Tanya asked, as we pushed tables together and dragged chairs over so we could all sit together.
"And do what with it?" Hart asked. "Put it in storage? Might as well leave it here until it's needed elsewhere. Luckily for us, there should still be quite a few resources here."
"Like food?" I asked.
"We'll check the storerooms in a bit. We're going to need to take an inventory of what we have here on the island and what we need to acquire in the future."
"Are you suggesting we live here?" Lucy asked.
"We have nowhere else to go. There's shelter here and warmth once we get the generators going. If there's anything else we need, like food, we can get it from the mainland. This place is our best hope for survival."
I wasn't going to argue with that. After the destruction of the Big Easy, I'd felt vulnerable and exposed. The boat had allowed us to stay at a safe distance from the zombie-infested mainland, and its loss had been a huge blow. This island would serve the same purpose as the Big Easy had. It was far enough from the mainland to be a safe haven, yet close enough that we could get supplies when we needed them.
"Our immediate goal is survival," Hart said. "The world has gone to hell in a handbasket, and if we're not careful, the human race will be wiped out altogether. At some point, we're going to have to go after Brigadier Gordon. He's a madman with a bomb. A bomb that turns ordinary people into monsters. We can't allow him to carry out whatever plans he may have regarding the use of that bomb."
A general murmur went around the table as everyone agreed. We'd seen firsthand what the Brigadier's bomb could do. The world was in enough trouble without him causing even more chaos.
"We're agreed, then," Hart said. "Our immediate objective is to get the generators on and restore power to this place. The food stores need to be checked, and an inventory needs to be taken."
He looked at me.
"Alex, since you're so interested in the food situation, that can be your job. Choose another person to help you. I want everyone working in pairs until we know for sure that this island is indeed deserted."
"You think someone else is here?" Lucy asked, with a worried look in her face.
"We can't be sure. The scientists left ages ago, but that doesn't mean there's no one else here. I didn't see any boats when we arrived, but it's possible to hide such things."
Now I thought he was being paranoid. I could see why someone might sail to this island and take up residence here. But if that was the case, then surely they'd be here in the main buildings. It was unlikely that they'd be hiding in the woods or on the beach. Hart was a military man, though, so he'd want everything double-checked before he declared the island safe.
"I'll help, Alex," Sam volunteered. "I didn't say anything earlier, but I'm starving." "Fine," Hart said. "Just don't eat all the food."
Sam grinned.
"No worries, man." "Waters, Hamilton and Fletcher, check out the north side of the island."
The three security guards nodded and stood, pushing back their chairs. They left the canteen, checking their weapons as they went.
"Larson and Reeves, take the chopper up and have a good look at the island from the air."
The pilot, a fair-haired, blue-eyed man named Terry Reeves, and his co-pilot, a tall Danish woman named Claudia Larson, whose blonde hair was pulled back into a long plait, picked up their flight helmets from the table and also left. That left Hart, Sam, Tanya, Lucy and me at the table.
"While these two check the food situation," Hart said, pointing at Sam and me, "perhaps you ladies would like to check on the living arrangements. a couple of the outlying buildings were the scientists' quarters. You should be able to find bedding and that sort of thing. Might as well make our stay here as comfortable as possible.
You sure you don't want us to check the south side of the island? Tanya said. We're more than maids, Hart. We're kick-ass.
I'm sure you are. All right. You can join the search of the south side when the others get back from checking the north. But we still need a place to bed down, so until then, please check the outlying buildings for the basic necessities. Thank you.
Tanya looked like she was about to say something else, but Lucy grabbed her arm and pulled her to her feet. It's fine. We'll check the scientists' quarters. She guided Tanya out of the room.
What are you going to do, man? Sam asked Hart. You like giving out jobs, but I notice you didn't give one to yourself.
I'm going to get those generators started, he said, standing up.
By yourself? I asked. But you said we should...
I'll be fine. Now you boys whip up something tasty for when I get back.
He slung his carbine over his shoulder and left, whistling a tune I didn't recognise, but which sounded happier than the occasion demanded.
He seems cheerful, I said to Sam. He's a soldier. This is the sort of thing he thrives on. It's probably his greatest dream come true.
The zombie apocalypse? I don't think so.
We left the table and walked around the back of the serving area. The door to the kitchen was a simple swing door. We pushed through it. The kitchen was clean and functional, full of stainless steel work surfaces and pots and pans hanging from a steel bar that ran the length of the room.
Don't be so sure, Sam said. Guys like Hart love shit like this. Hey, there's a storeroom over here.
He pulled open a door, revealing a large room with cardboard boxes and plastic drums stacked from floor to ceiling. Sam looked at me and grinned.
Bingo!
We walked into the storeroom. With no working lights, it was dark, but I could make out some of the labels on the boxes. Baked beans, tinned tomatoes, rice, dried pasta, flour. We'd hit the motherload. There was enough food here for a few months.
What do you fancy for lunch? Sam asked. Pasta? There's some sauce here.
We carried a box of pasta and a box of sauce into the kitchen and placed them on the work surface. Sam took a small knife out of his back pocket and cut open the boxes, taking out three jars of pasta sauce and a couple of bags of dried pasta.
Do you think that will be enough? He asked.
I looked at the food sitting on the stainless steel surface. There had once been a time when I'd have been able to eat that amount of food all by myself.
We should probably add some more. There are 10 of us, remember?
Yeah, sure thing.
He pulled out 3 more bags of pasta and 2 more sauce jars. How are we supposed to cook it?
Until Hart gets the generators started, we don't have any electricity.
I inspected one of the cookers. The main oven was electric, but the rings on the hob were gas. I turned one on and heard the hiss of gas. I pressed down on the knob, and the ignition sparked the furthest ring into life.
We can use the gas, I told Sam. It probably runs off bottles, like in caravans.
Cool! Let's get cooking!
He selected a huge stainless steel pasta pot from the assortment hanging above our heads and dropped it onto the hob with a clang. I smiled inwardly. He'd chosen a scant amount of food, but the largest pan. The thing was industrial size, more than enough to hold our 5 bags of tagliatelle.
Maybe a smaller pan for the sauce, I suggested.
He grabbed a smaller pan and placed it on the hob.
We're going to need water in this one.
I tapped the pot and nodded towards the sink. There was no way I'd be able to carry this monstrosity once it was full of water. Sam shouldn't have much of a problem, though. He went over to the sink and turned on the tap.
It sputtered and popped for almost a minute. Then a steady stream of water flowed out. "There must be some sort of hydro system that utilises groundwater," Sam said. "Looks like no expense was spared for the comfort of the marine biologists." He hefted the pasta pot over to the sink and half-filled it with water before bringing it back and putting it on the burning gas ring. "I'm going to find some salt," he said, going back into the storeroom. While he was in there, I watched the water in the pot. It was going to take a while to heat up. I heard a click, followed by sudden low hum from across the room. I looked in that direction. There was a large fridge over there. I went over and opened the door. The light came on, showing empty shelves. "Art got the power on," I called to Sam. "Great!" The storeroom lit up as he put the lights on in there. "Aha! Salt and pepper." He came out with plastic tubs of each in his arms and put them down on the central island. "Okay, let's get this meal started." "We need to wait for the water to boil," I told him. Hart appeared at the door. "Turn it off for now. The exploration team has just radioed in. They've found something on the north side of the island. They're holding their position until we get there. They might need fire support." "Why?" I asked. "What did they find?" "They're not exactly sure. Waters said there's a boat and a dead body. But it isn't as straightforward as that."
"In what way?"
"She said we need to see it for ourselves." Sam rolled his eyes. "This doesn't sound good." "Grab your guns and let's go," Hart said. I turned the gas off and we followed Hart outside. Tanya and Lucy were already waiting for us, carbines slung over their shoulders. "It's not too far," Hart said, marching into the woods and heading north.
"What's so special about a dead body that we all have to see it?" Tanya asked.
"They said there was something weird about it. Come on, keep up."
He increased his pace.
As we moved to the northern edge of the island, my senses were on high alert and I scanned the trees around us. Weird didn't sound good. Chapter 2. The members of the security team were waiting for us at the northern edge of the woods. "What's the problem?" Hart asked.
"Like I said on the radio," Caroline Waters said, "you need to see this for yourself."
Josh Hamilton and Andy Fletcher, both standing behind her, were silent. But the worried looks on their faces said it all. Whatever they'd found had disturbed them.
"Is there an immediate danger?" Hart asked, looking at the faces of his team.
Waters shook her head.
"I don't think so, sir. It seems to be inert, but we haven't approached it, so I don't know what it would do if we got closer."
Hart frowned.
"Show me."
We left the cover of the trees and moved across an open grassy area at the top of the northernmost cliff.
"The boat is down there," Waters said, pointing down at the coastline.
I inched to the edge of the cliff, with everyone else, and looked down. The sea had carved out a cove over the course of a few millennia, and there was a pebbly beach down there. A 42-foot yacht, similar to the Big Easy, sat on the pebbles, listing slightly to one side. Its hull had been split open, probably on the rocks that lay further out to sea, and the boat was covered with weeds and crustaceans. It had been abandoned to the sea and the elements some time ago.
"The body is over here," Waters said. "When you see it, you'll know why we didn't get too close."
She led us inland, back to the edge of the woods. Only this time, we followed the trees west for a couple of minutes, until Waters stopped and pointed. Hart saw the body first. He subconsciously took a step back and muttered,
"What the hell?"
I followed his gaze to the tree line, and my eyes widened with shock. I tightened my grip on the carbine. The body was laying on its back and had the mottled blue skin of a zombie, but there was very little flesh left. Bleached white bones poked out through the remaining skin at sharp angles, and it looked as if the rib cage had exploded. I was reminded of John Hurt's character, Kane, in the Alien movie, when the creature burst from his chest. But what had come out of this poor man's chest? I could tell from the sunken blue face that this had once been a fair-haired man in his 20s or 30s. Was some kind of fungus. It had slick grey tendrils that had erupted from the corpse and had snaked over the ground in all directions. The fungoid appendages reached about 30 feet around the body. Some of them had slithered up into the trees, while others lay on the ground.
"Everyone stay back," Hart said.
His words were redundant. There was something about the fungus that triggered a deep primal part of my brain and told me to turn and run. I was sure the others felt the same way. I wasn't going to take another step closer to the thing. It was all I could do to stop myself from fleeing the area and never coming back.
"Any ideas what that thing is?" Hart asked. "It's obviously a zombie," Fletcher said. "But I have no idea about that fungus. Anyone else?"
Nobody offered an opinion. None of us had seen anything like the fungus-infected zombie before.
"No one goes near it," Hart said, turning and walking back to the cliff edge. "I want a closer look at that boat."
"There's a way down there, sir," Hamilton said, pointing the muzzle of his gun at a rough path that angled down the side of the cliff to the beach.
"Hamilton, take point. Everyone else, behind me."
We fell into a loose formation behind Hart. Hamilton led the way across the cliff edge to the beginning of the path. The route was natural, not man-made, and looked dicey in places where the incline was steep and we'd have to climb over the rocks. But it was the only way to get to the boat, other than abseiling down the side of the cliff. Needless to say, I didn't fancy being lowered over the edge of the cliff with nothing but a rope between me and the beach below. Our descent was slow and careful. A strong wind blew in from the sea, whipping at us and threatening to peel us off the rocks. I tried to keep my centre of balance low, and made sure I was holding on to the cliff wall every step of the way. Hamilton and Hart didn't seem to be bothered by the weather conditions, and reached the pebbled beach a couple of minutes before the rest of us. When we were all on the beach, we raised our weapons and advanced on the wrecked boat. Waves crashed on the rocks, and salty spray drenched us. Pebbles rattled like small bones as the surf washed over them, before dragging them out to sea. Seagulls cried from somewhere above us. I didn't look up. My attention was fixed on the splintered hull of the boat. Anything could come running or slithering out of the large hole, and I didn't want to be taken unawares. Hart gestured to the three security team members, and they moved forward quickly. Waters covered the hole with her carbine, while Fletcher and Hamilton went around to the other side of the boat and boarded it. I heard shuffling and the banging of doors in there. Then Hamilton shouted, "Clear!" Everyone lowered their weapons. I slung mine over my shoulder and went around to the other side of the overturned boat, where a ladder attached to the stern allowed me to climb on board. The name, the Hermit, was painted on the side of the boat. Like the hull, the deck was covered with weeds. Fletcher came up from down below and leaned over the railing to report to Hart.
"Everything in the interior of the craft looks water damaged, sir. There's mould on everything. No signs of any other people on board, dead or otherwise. Looks like he was sailing alone."
Hamilton was up in the bridge. He looked down at Hart and said,
"The equipment up here looks fried. Nothing salvageable, sir."
I opened the door that led to below decks and grimaced at the smell of damp and mould that assailed my nostrils. I went down and found myself in a living space that wasn't unlike the Big Easy's. There was a living room and a small kitchen, overgrown with green mould that sprouted from the furniture and the wet carpet, and had spread over the walls. A small door led to a cabin with a similarly mouldy bed. There was a laptop in here, but it was obviously water-damaged and beyond repair. I opened the top drawer in the bedside table, hoping to discover the identity of the man who'd sailed to this island alone and died up on the top of the cliffs. There was a hard-bound notebook in there with a blue cover. I pulled it out and opened it. The pages were covered with handwriting in blue ink that had bloomed over the paper in some places due to water damage, but wasn't totally destroyed. I saw dates and times on some of the entries. The guy had been keeping a journal. I went back outside and took the book with me. When I got back on deck, I took a deep breath of fresh, salty air, glad to be out of the mould-infested living quarters. I climbed down the ladder and dropped to the ground. "What have you got?" Hart asked, spying the book in my hand. "A journal. It might tell us who he was and why he was here." "All right. I'll leave it up to you to glean whatever information you can from it." "Thanks," I said, with more than a hint of sarcasm in my voice. Hart's attitude was beginning to rankle. I could see why he'd assumed he was in command. He was, after all, the boss of the security team and the helicopter pilots. But I didn't work for him, and I didn't appreciate being bossed around. If he heard the sarcastic tone in my reply, he didn't acknowledge it. He simply looked up towards the top of the cliffs and said, "There's a storm heading this way. Everyone back to base." Climbing back up the cliff path was no mean feat. After clambering over the rocks and making our way up the steep incline, we stood on the top and regained our breath while looking down at the boat and out to sea. No one looked in the direction of the fungus zombie. Hart was right about the storm. Dark clouds hung ominously over the sea a few miles away. "The north side of the island is off limits until we know what we're dealing with," Hart said. Nobody argued with that. If the others were thinking along the same lines as me, then they wanted to forget they'd ever seen that thing. We moved south, through the trees, back towards the buildings. A light rain began to fall, the drops bouncing off the foliage around us. The trees provided cover, and when we got back to base, we were damp but not drenched. "I'll get that pasta on," I said, as I entered the main building and turned towards the canteen. "Sam can do that," Hart said. "Your job is to find out what's in that journal." "I can read it in the kitchen while we're cooking." Sam and I went to the kitchen and relit the gas under the pasta pot. While we waited for the water to warm up, I leaned on the central island and carefully opened the damp journal. The first few pages were illegible. The ink that had once formed words was now a blue, amorphous stain. However, on the inside cover in bold black ink were the words, "The Adventures of Chris Sims and the Hermit." So, Fungus Guy's name was Chris Sims. I leafed ahead to the first legible entry and found one that was dated a couple of days after the zombie outbreak. I'd been hiking in Wales with Lucy, Mike and Elena on that day. Chris, it seemed, had been taking the Hermit out to sea. "Finally got the boat out. I had to avoid some crazies who were arguing at the marina, but managed to get away without incident. Good thing, too, because I wasn't up to fighting anybody. The bite that Fiona gave me hurts like a bitch, and my hand has swelled up to twice its normal size. Something big is happening, but there's a media blackout. All I can get on the radio is the BBC emergency broadcast." His name was Chris Sims, I told Sam, who was putting the pasta into the pot. He was bitten, back in the early days of the outbreak. Figures.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?